continuity funding and the ability to know what to expect. And this really hurts, particularly young, you know, startup companies that are on limited runway. And if that contract that they're expecting doesn't come through for a new start, you know, they're done, right? We have lost that industrial base. So, you know, I'm with you, Laura. This is only going to become louder and louder.
From the Defense and Aerospace Report, this is The Downlink, a podcast about the intersection of space, the space business, and defense. Not just what's over the horizon, but what's happening above it. I'm your host, Laura Winter.
This week, Frank Kendall, the Secretary of the Department of the Air Force, and Space Force Chief of Space Operations, General Chan Saltzman, returned to Capitol Hill, and they appeared before the Armed Services Committee for both the House and the Senate. The topic, like last week, was the president's budget request for FY 2025. As I've said before, Kendall and Saltzman have a tough road to walk. They have to give legislators their best military advice. That includes enumerating the various ways they say China's tactical military space capabilities are possibly now on par with those of the Space Force. And they have to dutifully defend the president's budget request, which includes a substantial reduction in buying power compared to what was requested for this year. The difference just for procurement is more than $455 million. The space economist George Pullen has called this a pumping of the brakes. So you might ask, what's a legislator to do to get some unvarnished ground truth? He or she may just pick up and read the State of the Space Industrial Base Report. The latest edition has just been released, and it's what we're going to discuss in this episode. But first, there are a few things to know. The authors represent the Space Force, the Defense Innovation Unit, and the Air Force Research Laboratory. But, and this is real important, the views illustrated in this report do not represent official policy. Instead, they are the result of a series of workshops held in places where the Commercial Space Industrial Base is located. Those who attend, mostly military and commercial space leaders, they come to have some clear talk to give their undiluted raw views on what they think are the top priorities for space security. The next workshop is a month away in Albuquerque, New Mexico. If you're interested in attending, look up New Space Nexus. It's this workshop's organizer. And so, because it's not like any other event out there, the product, the State of the Space Industrial Base Report, is uniquely informative. Here with me to discuss the latest report is Steve Bucky Buto and Peter Gerritsen. But first, a quick message from our generous sponsors. This podcast is brought to you by TE Connectivity. When the mission is critical, so are the parts. TE Connectivity's components are exactingly engineered, rigorously tested, and certified by major space agencies. Learn more at te.com/space. Now here's our conversation. Hey, Bucky, Peter, thank you both so much for making the time to come on the podcast.
Thank you, Laura.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, before we dive into what's really become a very consequential document of record, the State of the Space Industrial Base Annual Report, let's take a quick moment for a short round of introductions. And Peter, as you are the veteran here on the podcast, why don't you kick this off?
Well, thank you, Laura. My name is Peter Gerritsen. I'm a senior fellow in defense studies at the American Foreign Policy Council, the author of a couple books, and relevant to today, I am one of the editors of this year's State of the Space Industrial Base Report.
And Bucky?
That's right.
Don't leave anything out. You are a major general.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to do this or you want me to?
I want you to do it. Go for it.
Sure. Hi there. I'm Steve Bucky Buto. Bucky's my call sign. I'm the director of the space portfolio for the Defense Innovation Unit. We're part of the Secretary of Defense, the Office of Secretary of Defense. Our mission is to accelerate the adoption of commercial technology at speed and scale. So we'll We'll talk about that. And yes, I'm also in the military as a reservist and with a lot of my hands there. So I'm here in my civilian capacity today with Peter to talk about the work that we did on the State of the Space Industrial Base Report 2023 edition.
Thank you both so much again. Now, to begin with, we simply can't expect everyone to know just what this report actually represents, you know, whose voices are there, or why the DIU or the Space Force or the Air Force Research Laboratory takes on this task. So briefly, can we explain, you know, how this report comes about so that we can spend the lion's share of the conversation on what this year's report actually says? You know, Bucky, how did the State of the Space Industrial Base report even germinate? You know, what's the origin story and what information vacuum are you trying to fill?
Well, it's interesting. 5 years ago, we got together with our friends at the AFRL, the Air Force Research Laboratory in Albuquerque. AFRL's large profile, a portfolio of capabilities. And we got together with the director there and also some others and said, you know, there's things going on, a lot of things that are threatening the commercial space industry, largely from a foreign influence, a lot of market manipulation, things like this. And that story is not getting told. It's not getting captured. So we organized the very first, it was a 2-day workshop. We did it here in Mountain View, or not far from where I'm sitting at our DIU headquarters. And we invited industry in. And what we did is we really gave the microphone to industry and said, tell us what's on your mind. What are your challenges? What opportunities do you see? How can we be doing a better job of helping you? And at that time, in the very first report, which was, I'll just call it the China, China, China report, because what was happening is companies, especially in the photovoltaic sector, were really being pushed out of the marketplace. And we had no policy. And there was very, other than in the intelligence and the law enforcement sectors, there was not a lot of visibility to this. And I think what was great with that first report is it created a dialogue on the government side that eventually resulted in a lot better organization to make it more difficult for adversarial powers to come in and do things to take advantage of our commercial industrial base. So that was how it got started. And I think what's really important about that, when we published the report, we've done this from day one, is that because these are not the views of the government, it's the views of industry. Yeah, we put a big, bold disclaimer in there. So while we are authors and editors represented here today, we're really facilitators. We facilitate this discussion. We take good notes, and then we publish results. And then we take recommendations that we can take back for action within our silos here in the government side to work. But, you know, we've done that. I think that's one of the best attributes about what we've done over the last 5 years is once a year we get this dialogue. It promotes some discussion. And as I'm sure we'll talk about later, a lot of that discussion evolves into policy.
So who is your intended audience then? And what do you want that intended audience to actually do?
Well, I think we have multiple audiences. You know, because we're giving the microphone to industry, I think the primary audience really is the nuts and bolts policymakers, both within Congress and within the executive branch, who have, you know, really agency to put the institutional acupuncture where it needs to be in order to, you know, get the space chief flowing so that we're able to be as competitive as we possibly can be. But it turns out that in capturing this, it becomes quite an amazing almanac, capturing facts in a yearbook of, you know, what has happened in the previous year and also sort of where things are going. And that becomes very valuable to go back and see, well, what has changed? You know, what is adapting? What's not adapting? And I think it ends up being an especially valuable document for the commercial sector because they can really see sort of where is the conversation now? You know, what gets reflected? What have they said that gets heard? What comes out in terms of recommendations? So I think it really serves the entire community, the entire ecosystem. But in terms of, like, you know, who is the document itself targeted at? it's targeted those who are able to make the changes, typically on the government side, to make it better. Although we have from time to time made recommendations focused on the financial sector and others who might have agency.
Yeah. And now I'll just add on to that, that really, the if you say more specifically, the target audience for the workshops, we really want the commercial space companies there. And that's a wide variety of them. There's some of them are new startups. There's some very big companies in there as well. Anyone who's transacting and doing things in space, and that population grows every year, largely due to the increased access to space, which is something we can really see a huge difference over the last 5 years. And it's not just you look at the cover of the report; it's not just access to low Earth orbit. You know, it's access to cislunar space and beyond. And I think that's what's really exciting. The commercial sector is really vibrant. You know, you can already tell 24 reports can be difficult because there's so many things going on. You know, if you think about what made Silicon Valley special, it was this convergence of industry, academia, and government. And while there's no necessarily a geographic hub for space, but what you have is you have that confluence of industry, academia, and government that's really enabling all this rapid innovation and progress in space today. It's really magical to see. And I think that that's going to be, in the historical view, I think that's going to be recognized as something that was really transformative in this 21st century.
Hang on, I'm going to tag on real quick myself, because I really want to touch upon something that Bucky just said, and that was the use of the word magical, right? Mm-hmm. Because when I first met you, Peter, I said, you know, hey, what do you think? Should I go or should I not go to Albuquerque? And I remember you told me, and, you know, I'm sort of semi-quoting you here, but you said, this is the one event that you will want to go to. And, you know, I'm a journalist. So I rolled my eyes. And then I got there. And that's where it comes back to that word magical. It is actually a really magical event. It's a really magical event because these space companies are able to come here and actually also speak truth to power, right? I mean, and that the power is actually listening to them, whether, like you just said, whether they're, you know, bootstrapping startup or whether they've been here, done that, and now actually produce the t-shirts, right? And I wanted, you know, either one of you, if you could just sort of explain, if you are a space company or a company that's part of the space supply chain, mm-hmm. right? Is this an exclusive event? Is this invitation only? You know, who can participate? And if somebody comes to participate in the workshop, which these outputs from those workshops actually feed into the report, you know, what can they expect from that experience?
Well, I'll tell you that it is open. There's typically a landing fee, or it depends on who's hosting the workshop, but largely because these things aren't free. But the ability to contribute, we have people who show up in person. We have every year, except for the first year, we did online, so you can be virtually in attendance. And it's good. And we really go out of our way to make sure that we have the most input possible. And not just from one region of the country. You know, a year or two ago, we decided to say, hey, we have to start spreading our wings. So we have workshops in Northeast in Seattle, down Southeast in Florida. We got some new locations we're exploring. We've not yet been to the Northeast, right? Which is really the financial sector. And we're very interested in getting up there. There's absolutely phenomenal space companies in the heartland of the country. And so we really want this to be an inclusive report from all sectors, all portions of it. And we're getting attendees from even traditional space companies who are also, they're struggling and actually in some ways because of policy that say, hey, we could do more by integrating with the commercial companies and creating really fantastic things. I think you see that playing out with how Derek Turnier and the Space Development Agency does the work. So we'll have people from, as Peter said, from different stakeholders in the government space. We have the commercial companies this last year. This report is the first time we invited, you know, our partners and allies participating in discussions. that's like what's really exciting to me. I think that space is really something for, it's going to elevate all of humanity, and we do it the right way, and we want to have strong partners in every facet of how we do that.
You know, just to add on to that, I think, you know, what's really different about sort of the tenor and the type of conference this is, you know, it's not like a hockey or wares, you know, sort of industry conference. It's not a policy pronouncement. You know, it's not the place that you go in order to like hear what the customer wants to tell you. You know, it really is a workshop where people sit down collaboratively, people who care about on both sides of the government and private sector about what's going to be good for the ecosystem, and are working collaboratively to come up with what is the next level of recommendations that needs to, well, where are we at now? What are the problems? And then what are the next level things that we need to do with as much specificity as possible? You know, who should be doing it? When should they be doing it? You know, how is it connected to other things? And so it really is a place to create policy.
Definitely a workshop. I mean, you don't come to this conference to not work. You come to this conference to work. And there's a lot of, I mean, sometimes the dialogue gets really spicy. I mean, people are very passionate about these topics.
So let's get on with the meat of this discussion, which is really about what's in the latest report, which is the 2023 report. Now that we have this basis, we also know that this last year has been a rough one for space companies, most especially those small to medium-sized companies that are developing these new technologies that everybody wants, and more specifically, the Space Force and others that have space equities. And it's been written in a number of investor-related reports that government contracts, especially DoD contracts, are what private investors prize. And like canaries in a coal mine, the commercial companies that participated last year, they identified this as a major theme. And now with the presidential budget request cutting most space-related budgets, this is going to be a theme, a concern that is only going to intensify. That is clear. So what I'm actually wondering, though, is what is the top takeaway from this latest report, because we already know that we're in a money crunch, that you think legislators or policymakers also need to really take on board? You know, what in your opinion is urgent, Bucky?
Well, I want to just dissect that a little bit. So I think when industry is smart, which they are, they're not just targeting DoD contracts, but they are looking at government contracts, right? And the reason why is like if I was on the commercial side, I'm not, but who would walk away from like one of the fabulous contracts that NASA's written for commercial services and things like that? And you have to really applaud what NASA has done, because the public-private partnerships they've done over the last 10 years plus have actually yielded really large results. And those were not small contracts. On the Department of the Defense side, when we got started, you know, our constraint was, you know, we have to go after very specific things that we need, and there's a process for defining something. One of the first projects that I did at DIU was really focused on day-night all-weather, you know, remote sensing, right? There were zero U.S. commercial synthetic aperture radar space companies. We would buy data from Italy, Germany, Japan, and Canada. And that was largely because we had a policy that we didn't allow the commercial sector to do certain types of sensing from space. But then that changed, and that's how that all got started. And now today, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I wouldn't be surprised to know that the U.S. is a global leader in commercial synthetic aperture radar sensing, because it's optimized for analytics, and the way the government licenses it, people all over the globe can benefit from those services. So those commercial companies really like being able to compete and win awards, contracts in the global economy, which is really so necessary. because none of us on the government side can really honestly say that we can keep these companies going nonstop. You know, one of the little tidbits, it's actually the second time we published it, but it's just a recurring theme. We spent 3.5 of the last 10 years in continuing resolution with inability to transact. So it's absolutely essential that we're disciplined enough that if we work with a commercial company, that we don't distract them from their commercial business case. We want the work that we do with them to amplify, you know, that commercial business case. That's actually one of the underlying themes of this thing that Peter can talk about, CASR, right? The commercially augmented space reserve. But the good news is this: we're finding that we can actually save money by using commercial where commercial fits like a glove, right? And we can actually save money and help scale architectures if we integrate commercial where commercial fits like a glove. So fits like a glove is, I kind of coined that today, but it's really, really important because we can't just go out and use a commercial asset to go and do warfighting operations. We can have warfighting things that have commercial technology embedded in them. That's been the history of the Department of Defense probably since it started. But it's important that we recognize what the market opportunities are and are not.
And Peter, as the editor, you have collated all of these incredible metrics on launch, up mass, which is how much mass is launched to space, the number of new and relevant policies and plans, as well as what's upmost in the minds of participants. Could you give us a taste of some of those metrics and explain the one you think? Which one do you think is the most significant? And does it relate to defense? There's been a lot of progress.
Well, you know, one of the things that's just stunning is the projection of what would be the satellite purchases for the next coming decade compared to what they actually were. And, you know, they projected this flat and declining growth. And in fact, it's this exponential curve. And, you know, it is fairly amazing, you know, that, you know, for the year that we were looking at, you know, there had been 186 orbital launches that had deployed like 2,521 total spacecraft. And I remember when I first started teaching space at Air University, there was like a total of 1,200 satellites in orbit when I started tracking it myself. That's stunning. You know, it's even more stunning that, you know, the United States accounted for just under half that, about 47%, with China at like 34% and Russia at 11%. But the performance in terms of like actual upmass is even more stunning. So, you know, humanity launched like just over 1,000 metric tons into space that prior year. And the U.S. was in the lead with 70% of that upmass. And even though China, you know, had about 34% of global launches, it was only 18% of upmass. And while Russia was like 11% of launches, you know, it was not even 7%. So that's pretty interesting. And then SpaceX alone is like providing 62% of global upmass and 88% of what we're doing nationally. But at the same time, you know, China's, you know, basically doubled its number of on-orbit assets in just the last few years. You know, it's really radically increased its number of launches. So it's also, you know, it has yet to hit its knee in the curve. But it's on an exponential launch. And if you combine, you know, Russia and China, you know, we're neck and neck. So those things stood out. And then, you know, on the policy side, I mean, it is astounding. You know, there were like something like 5 important policy documents that came out of the White House. There were a couple that came out of OSD. You know, then the Space Force came out with its new mission statement. It announced its commercial strategy that hadn't come out yet. It provided its competitive endurance strategy. And then there was, you know, stuff with U.S. Spacecom becoming IOC. But I think, you know, going back to your earlier question, one of the things that was just absolutely stunning for me was to realize that over the past decade, we have spent 34% of that decade under a continuing resolution. And so, like,
previous. So what could we do if we actually were funded properly is like the question, right?
Truly, you know, I mean, as Secretary Kendall said in his Senate, you know, we basically, you know, I think he said we lost 5 of 15 years. You know, it's the same here. You know, we've lost, you know, 3.5 of 10 years, right? I mean, that's that's truly hobbling us. So if there is one thing that really stands out to me, and to go back to your last question of like, what should you also take away from, is that kind of the biggest enemy of national security are continuing resolutions. And, you know, if we cannot get our you know, fiscal, and I've heard this from numerous sources, right, that it isn't even the level of funding. It is the continuity of funding and the ability to know what to expect. And this really hurts, particularly young, you know, startup companies that are on limited runway. And if that contract that they're expecting doesn't come through for a new start, you know, they're done, right? We have lost that industrial base. So, you know, I'm with you, Laura. This is only going to become louder and louder. And I expect that, you know, the commercial sector will become increasingly noisy about this with Congress, and it will eventually make its way to become an election issue.
In the short term, you know, really good commercial companies in this sector have already secured some level of funding. They have some margin, right, because of that. But the way space works, sector works, you know, it's not like a software company. Software companies, most of your capital is involved with people and salaries and benefits, and it's a much lower operating cost, you know, to have a launch company, to have a satellite company. The burn rates are very high, and the companies don't raise all the money up front because they would give the company away. They have to raise it over time. And their ability to raise money is also influenced by their ability to bring in some revenue and get some business with government and non-government stakeholders. So it's really good when we can actually deliver on that. But we have a growing population of people every day who do business with us that that they see this and they know it. And actually, the best thing they can do is just take that back to their legislators. And we can't put that in the report enough, you know, but we're not a legislative body, you know.
Right. The legislators is really where the rubber hits the road on actually, you know, moving out on getting a budget. I mean, the president can, you know, pitch the budget all he or she wants, depending upon who's, you know, who's in. Yeah. But without Congress, it just doesn't go anywhere.
Well, exactly. And I think you know, maybe we'll take this on. I don't know. But what are the cascading effects that happen when we go into one of these CRs? Because one of the first things that happens on the government side is, you can't hire anybody, or you may not be able to extend somebody. And so you could have like a total turnover of talent. You have these programs, there's no new starts. So there could have been something that the department's been working on for a long time. That delay, it cascades, it pushes things down, and then you wind up paying more for them over time. But that's not unique to space. That's the entire Democratic establishment, and we can't fix that on inside of the government side. I think that's something that the electorate has to take on.
Let's go to the positive side of these policies, especially the metrics that Peter just explained, right? There have been so many policies and strategies, you know, coming out of here, there, and everywhere. And you've got to be pretty proud there, Bucky, because, you know, for instance, this report has been used to shape these policies, like the National Low Earth Orbit Research and Development Strategy. Mm-hmm. Take a moment. Tell us about this.
Well, so that strategy came out of the White House, right? And a great team there, both at the Office of Science and Technology Policy and National Space Council. And what's really great is, for the last, probably from the second half of the Obama administration forward, we've had a steady stream of policy statements. And the continuity of that policy is truly bipartisan, which is really, really, really important, because we're not rocking the boat. And I actually think that a great deal of progress can be attributed to that. For instance, if you look at this 2023 report, the theme is actually an extraction from a strategy document. So that's the national defense strategy in terms of building enduring advantages. And we brought in not just the economic prosperity, but for collective security, meaning it's not just national security, but the collective of all of our allies and partners. And so we are leveraging strategy that came out of the administration to say, well, this is a central theme. So how are we, what are we doing to make that strategy real? There's obviously a dialogue with that, but an interesting thing, we try to highlight this every year. One of the unsung heroes over this past decade, especially the last 5 years, regulators, if you think about it, regulators and those people who actually give the licenses out, they have like zero growth, the same number of people. They're dealing with this huge, all those metrics that Peter came up with. People are, you know, how do we do space traffic management? How do we make sure that we have things that launch and recover safely? You know, how do we mission track and is those satellites performing safely and we have safe disposal? What are the things that we need to look at in the future? I mean, there's a whole army of people inside the government that actually bring all this together. And it's really important that we recognize their efforts.
And I think I just add to that, that a lot of those people show up to the working groups.
They do.
Of this, right? So I think the value out of this is, you know, we really do sort of serve as we prep the field, right? This is sort of the idea lab. You know, before something is policy, people have to develop, you know, socialize ideas. And so, you know, you're likely to see it first in the report and even earlier, you know, in discussions when people are trying out, grappling, you know, with ideas. And, you know, just like Bucky says, the report itself flows from higher level policies and goals about what we want. And then it looks at where the blockages are and suggests both new policies and, you know, modifications to make the existing policies more successful. And so I think that, you know, what you get out of an effort like this is to really sort of caulk the entire policymaking process so that when people are ready and really like, yeah, that's the right idea, they have full chamber loaded of ideas.
Now, there's something in this report that really caught me by surprise, which is why I love this event and the report, because oftentimes surprising things get discussed. And that is whether the government should establish a U.S. Department of Space. What's the impetus? Why are some in the space community believing there needs to be a cabinet-level engagement for space?
Well, you know, certainly this is not a new idea. It's been around, but, you know, why is it gaining currency now? I think it's all part of the same frustration that folks are feeling, that there are all these different aspects of space, particularly sort of on the civil commercial side, that are uncoordinated. You know, part of that, you know, is part of the same, like, how do we regulate novel activities? Part of it is the frustration with not having a single front door for companies. Part of it is just realizing that as important as NASA by itself is, you know, the NASA administrator is not a cabinet level official and so does not have that, you know, daily ability to go in and provide some oomph. And there are many mixed feelings about, you know, the relative value of the National Space Council, because it can either be very active or it might not be. And while the vice president, you know, may be a very powerful actor, it's sort of, you know, they're going to be spread thin across many things. So the possibility of like having a deliberate agency that has sort of an institutional cabinet level idea to move forward. And then I would say that behind all of that is sort of a background assumption of this report, right? And that background assumption is that America has this very expansive spacefaring future, that it wants to go after economic development and settlement, that we need to have this North Star vision. And if you think that space is going to be, you know, a central theater of prosperity and security, then perhaps you want to organize for that success in the long term. And so, you know, you've seen over the last year or two people actually writing, like, how might this be done? What would you transfer? What might be in it? And others talking about it. So it got raised again, or I would say that it got raised more significantly, you know, for the first time in this report.
I know it's interesting. And of course, you know, this is part of the town hall or town square aspect of these working groups, is that, you know, there's no bad ideas and things get elevated forward. I thought the most interesting part of the discussion, though, is, and this is something that we put into the report, is really, we said it's the tale of two agencies, right? You have the Department of Energy, which was very deliberately planned and organized over time. And the Department of Energy is like the gold standards, right, I would say. The Department of Homeland Security were great people, great capabilities, everything, but it was really formulated out of crisis. And it's taken 10 years to get through all that stuff. And there's still some challenges that we won't go into here, but in terms of authorities and things like that. But I do think that it's interesting to say as an intellectual exercise, you can't just float an idea like that. It needs to be deliberately planned, and there's always good and bad and ugly with with things. I kind of like smaller government that's more effective. So, but
sometimes some things are just so big. Right. That, I mean, because this is cross-cutting. Right. I mean, this is economic. Yeah. This is energy. This is defense.
I'm very bullish. I think there's ways that we can actually tackle a lot of the challenges of the commercial sector without having to stand up a new agency. And actually, one of the things that I hope you'll start to see in these reports going forward is that the amount of collaboration across the interagency, that's where the rubber meets the road. If we can work together horizontally across government, that actually is very helpful. And I'll go back to my 2016 story I was telling earlier with the very early commercial satellite companies. Once some of the other agencies and the regulators understood that there was interest in the Department of Defense, it made a huge difference in our ability to help the companies get through the licensing process and a lot of other things. And so that didn't involve anything more than me going to a meeting and saying, we're working with these companies and we're here to express the fact that we think they're going to bring value to our mission area. And that was all that was required, right? So I think we have some work to do, but I'm all for better communication and collaboration across the government. I think some of these workshops have actually been helpful to even promoting some of that. And then we'll see how things go.
Now, in the past week, in testimony before Congress and speeches made at the Space Symposium, the fact that when the United States engages in military action, it does so almost always with allies and partners. This is for kinetic and for, lest we forget, humanitarian operations, right? The Quad originated from a multilateral humanitarian response to the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. The United States, India, Japan, and Australia have built upon that event to include international security concerns beyond the Indian Ocean and into space. There have been some important space and defense-related agreements on a bilateral and multilateral basis, such as October's Technology Safeguards Agreement, which is a treaty-level agreement with Australia, which allows U.S. space technology like rockets and satellites to be launched from Australia. Japan is welcoming the activation of a U.S. Space Force component in that country, and that is expected to happen this year. And when India's prime minister visited Washington last year, he was quite clear that he wanted greater military cooperation in all domains, and specifically space. So I was really interested to read that, and I'm quoting now, 14 plus allies have national military space capabilities. To integrate and make full use of this potential, synergy will require innovations in U.S. policy. Nevertheless, with few exceptions, space is insufficiently recognized as a potential security cooperation opportunity. So where are the insufficiencies, right? I mean, it's been a pretty amazing week. I mean, just to kick it off, right? We have Switzerland and Sweden on Monday and Tuesday just signed up to become members of the Artemis Accords. So things are moving forward. It's not like it's stuck in the mud.
So I think I'm going to touch on something from a historical context. The government really venturing into space was at the beginning of the Cold War, right? And it was really the evolution of ballistic missiles and intercontinental ballistic systems for that challenge, and really very, very high level of security, no foreign, you know, type of classifications and things like that. Because at that time in the 1950s, early 60s, it was really a global Hatfield and McCoys with a bunch of weapons pointed at each other. So I think everything that's unfolded from that time is really kind of the unraveling of those early days. There's a lot of regulatory processes, which is really intended to mostly keep these types of weapon systems from drifting overseas and into the wrong hands. So I think that there's a very complex backdrop here. It's amazing what has actually transpired since that time. And the fact that commercial companies are building, very complex, incapable rocket systems. They're basically launch vehicles, right? Where we want to be in the future. Wouldn't it be great if everybody had an Iron Dome, right? At the point where you don't have to worry about the proliferation of missiles and things of this nature, that relaxes a little bit. But it is a big problem. I mean, these are rockets are fast flying hypersonic capabilities that can deliver a lot of death and destruction. So that's the backstory. However, things like the AUKUS agreement and the recently signed technology safeguard agreement with Australia, there's TSAs in the works with other allies and partners. Very, very, very exciting. And not just for military capabilities, but the enabling commercial capabilities, right? That's good. And I think the U.S. and its allies will benefit from having launch diversity, having other spaceports that they're capable of providing resiliency. There's a lot to it, but ultimately the space economy upon which our national security and our collective security will be built, we want the Western countries to be strong in that regard. And
to be a real team.
And be a real team.
Because exactly. These different nations bring different strengths.
Exactly. And so if you're doing manufacturing in space, launching and returning things to the United States is going to be really complex until you can meet all the regulatory safety standards. Starting in a place like Australia may be a good way to go. And so there's all kinds of pluses and minuses. And the important thing is, through these collaborative agreements and partnerships, more things become possible than were in previous years.
I mean, this was really an interesting, it had for me a little bit different tone than the other sections, because it seemed to me like there was no lack of strategy here, right? The key leaders had articulated what they wanted. This was really a question of kind of like culture eats strategy for lunch, that, it's not enough to just say something, that there really has to be the incentives, the cultural change, at the lower level for you to be able to implement. At the high level, it's very clear that the United States policymakers want us to go. But I mean, there is an example of like with India, yet we've wanted this for 11 years and it hasn't come to fruition, right? And why is that? It's because we just don't have the clarity on the lower level mechanisms. And that's tough to get if you don't have the kind of the lower level buy-in.
Well, there's another way to look at this though, too. The strongest relationships are those that are built on trust. And trust is not a binary on-off switch. You build trust over time. You cultivate relationships. And you earn trust, right, in the things that you do. I think what's very exciting is, we have things that we're doing global partnership-wise, even through the Defense Innovation Unit, because it's important to the department. And so we send our emissaries out and we find ways to work together in a way that builds on that trust and creates more opportunities in the future. The key thing is consistency. Policy and diplomacy are things that they're like wine. They take time to really become to perfection, right? So you can't shorter chef those a fine bottle of wine. You gotta cultivate that over time. And I think that's an important thing for us to realize. That, and you mentioned Artemis earlier. We have a very peripheral level of interaction on Artemis, because Artemis is something we're doing for humanity and for peaceful exploration of space. But it's like that's really important, because all those countries that sign on to it, a lot of those countries have commercial companies that actually offer products and services that would be beneficial to us in the national security, collective security spectrum. So I think that's just a really good, really good policy execution.
We have run out of time. I want to thank you both so much for coming on the podcast and discussing this really important report. Thank you both so much.
Well, thank you, Laura.
That's it for this week. For your daily dose of award-winning defense coverage, listen to the Defense and Aerospace Report with Vago Maradian. And for the maritime domain, listen to Cavis Ships with Chris Cavis and Chris Cervello, and get your air domain news and analysis from the Air Power Podcast with JJ Gertler and Vago Maradian. I'm Laura Winter. Thank you for listening.